Call to order a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, March 21st, 2007. We will be holding public hearings on three bills today, and I think that there may well be amendments or issues raised about them, so unlikely that they will go to work session today. And we'll take them in the order in which they're posted on the agenda for today. So we'll open first a public hearing on House Bill 2895. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. House Bill 2895 first. Relates to duties of health care providers. ORS 676.260 requires the health care provider to notify a law enforcement officer or agency within 5 calendar days if the provider reasonably believes the following. 1, that there's a person receiving treatment. 2, after a motor vehicle accident. 3, in which the person was likely a driver. 4, the person has a blood alcohol content of 0.08 or greater as revealed by a blood test. The notice that the health care provider must provide to the law enforcement officer or agency consists of the name of the person, the blood alcohol level, and the date and time of the blood test. House Bill 2895 amends ORS 676.260 to require that the health care provider give notice immediately to any law enforcement officer who is at the health care facility and is investigating the accident. If there is no such officer available, the provider must notify a law enforcement agency in the county in which the accident occurred within 6 hours of becoming aware of the blood test results, as opposed to the existing law, which is 5 days and does not specify what county.
Very good. Thank you, counsel. We have several witnesses signed up. We have 2 from Carm Victims United, Marie Armstrong and Ann Pratz. Or, I'm sorry, Representative Barker. Your bill. I beg your pardon. There you are.
There he is.
I looked around and thought, he's out of the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jeff Barker. I guess, did you open the hearing?
Yeah, I did open the hearing. Yes.
Thank you. State Representative from District 28, Beaverton, Iowa. I'm going to try to keep my comments brief as there are several people going to testify on this bill. I sponsored this bill because I want to make sure that when an intoxicated driver is involved in an auto accident and is taken to a health care facility, law enforcement is notified. This is particularly the case when someone has been hurt or even killed in an accident. You will hear that this is a complicated bill and has created many legitimate concerns with both health care providers and health care professionals. My office is working with the stakeholders to try to produce amendments to this bill that everybody can live with. As I said, there's other people to testify, so I'll finish here. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions for Representative Barker? Thank you, Vice Chair Barker. Now we have a couple of people from Crime Victims United, Ann Pratt and Marie Armstrong. Why don't you come forward?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Pratt, and I'm here from Crime Victims United. I'm also a member of MAD and the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. Crime Victims United requested this bill along with Marie Armstrong and Dark Hall because we saw the need to encourage cooperation between law enforcement and hospital and medical centers who may be treating intoxicated drivers. DUI in our state is against the law. Certainly we want to identify the intoxicated driver and get them off our roads. In some cases, we need the cooperation of hospitals and medical facilities that have drawn drugs for treatment purposes and discover that the patient is legally intoxicated, 0.08 BAC or above. Law enforcement needs to be notified immediately. There is sometimes a fatality. One or more people have been killed. As an example, the tragic death of the 2 Eugene Symphony members just recently. My son was killed by a drunk driver in 1998, and I can only imagine how I would feel if the hospital did not comply with the law and did not draw the blood. In a moment, you will hear from Marie Armstrong, who experienced that very nightmare And I will, but I will let her tell her her story. In my testimony, written testimony, you will find a copy of an article called Slipping Through the Cracks that was published in 2001 by Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Some things have changed. For instance, the BAC in all states is now 0.08. But some of the other things have not changed. There are still some of the same problems in our hospitals today, such as by hospital personnel, insurance issues, personal beliefs, and privacy issues. The truth is that HIPAA, the federal privacy law, allows for disclosure if required by law. Oregon law requires a hospital or other provider to notify law enforcement when, following a motor vehicle crash, hospital personnel have blood tests indicating that a person was intoxicated while driving under the influence. It isn't always happening and is sometimes very inconsistent. Also in my statement that I handed in, you will find two examples. They're actually the same hospital where that did happen. Comments regarding the two major hospitals in my area, I will call them Hospital A and Hospital B, were very different. Hospital A, the law enforcement officer that I spoke with, who has worked for many years on Dewey's and other crimes, said of Hospital A, "It depends on who is working at the time and when the person comes in. I have had to threaten to arrest staff at the hospital for interfering and obstruction, plus making sure everyone on the staff is subpoenaed for the case. Other times he has indicated he has had cooperation, but has needed to have much patience in gaining those results. He said of Hospital B, they are very helpful. We have no problem. They usually draw blood before we arrive. We have similar reports from around the state, and you can see that we need change. We need consistency. We're seeking cooperation with these medical facilities. We've had discussions and are working in a committee with them on negotiations involving the medical industry. We hope that these negotiations do prove to be productive and beneficial for all of us." Also, supporting this bill is the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and OSPOA. I also have a MAD statement that I have been asked to hand in to you and asked to read the paragraph that just basically sums it up. As part of MAD's campaign to eliminate drunk driving, one element is full support of high visibility enforcement. This includes the access to technologies and tools that keep impaired drivers off the road and impose serious sanctions. Thus, MAD supports House Bill 2895 and also 2896. Thank you for your time and attention in hearing this bill. And at this time, I will introduce Marie Armstrong, and she will tell her story.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Ms. Armstrong.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Armstrong. I'm a member of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and Crime Victims United, but I'm here today speaking on my own behalf. I'm here to ask the committee to pass House Bill 2895. When my son Chance was killed on March 8, 1996, there was no blood testing done on either driver. Chance and Sarah were hit twice by two different vehicles. One driver was a hit and run until they found her at the hospital. She had some cuts on her face. The driver that killed my son was also taken to the hospital with a dislocated shoulder. Both drivers were at the hospital, and the hospital personnel must have smelled some type of alcohol on him because, as the police report reported, everyone at the scene smelled alcohol on both drivers. We did not get the justice that we should have. I started to think that we would never have justice until I will never forget the phone call I received from Detective Lamb that stated that they would not be able to charge either driver because of lack of evidence. I started to interview law enforcement agencies in personnel in the middle of 2003 when I started speaking at the victim impact panel in Linn County and Lane County. All of the officers that I had talked to had come up with the same scenario, that they could not get anyone to give them the reporting or they did not take the blood testing. I was very disappointed that in the 11 years since my son's death, nothing had changed. And I have talked to officers in Lane County, Douglas County, Linn County, and Portland area. I'm also the victim advocate for MAD, and I have been supporting a family in the Douglas County. This car crash happened a year ago. The hospital that took care of the surviving driver and the passenger would not give any results to the law enforcement. With this shortage of law enforcement, they do not have the time to go chase this down. And what happened in this case and in my case, the victims have to do the legwork. The victims should not have to do this. We're all here to work together. A month after the car crash, they found the blood testing at OSHU. The victim is still doing some of the legwork to try to get justice. I would like to leave the committee members with this thought. You receive a call from a hospital. Your son and daughter has been in a car crash. You get to the hospital. Either you find out they're dead on arrival, or they have a 7% chance of living. Then you find out that the hospital would not give any information to the law enforcement officer that was standing there. And the individual that killed your son or daughter is walking out. What would you do? I have been living with this for the last 11 years. I have so many questions that I will never receive answers for. We are all here today for the same reason, to save lives. Don't let another family go with what so many of the victims and the families are going through. Please pass 2895. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong, and we certainly are sympathetic to both of you for the losses that your families have suffered. Are there any questions from the committee for either of these witnesses? And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kevin Neely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Neely, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The Oregon District Attorneys Association strongly supports House Bill 2895. Again, I think that Ms. Pratt and Ms. Armstrong have effectively stated why this bill is critical, as with Representative Barker. I can tell you that from the perspective of the district attorneys, the chain of evidence is absolutely critical when it's time to move forward with the prosecution. What House Bill 2895 helps to do is ensure that that evidence is available when the time comes to prosecute a Dewey case. With that, I'd be happy to try and answer any questions. I also have Dina Ryerson here from the Oregon Department of Justice if you have any technical questions about Dewey prosecutions.
Are there any questions for Mr. Neely?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neely, as I read the bill, my concern is that the all this does is change the timing and who they notify. It doesn't really address the fact that they have to draw blood or they have to act. And that's a concern. I heard the previous two witnesses kind of pleading for that there's some action taken. So can you address that fact that the bill basically just from my perspective, speeds up the timing and says who they have to notify, but it doesn't put any teeth into requiring there to be a test done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, I think I can. House Bill 2896, which is the next bill on the list, I think will help to address that problem. That's my understanding of that bill, is that it, in fact, requires, it changes the word may to shall in the statutes that require a blood draw. Again, I think we can talk about that in the next bill.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Neely. Then Dark Hall.
Thank you, Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for allowing me to speak today. I'm a police officer, not a sergeant, not somebody that supervises, but somebody that has to use these laws every day. Two aspects of the law that I'd like to look at in regards to my duties, which are investigating crashes and investigating DUI drivers, are the aspects of finding out about a crash if we're not already aware of it, and also once we are aware of it, getting the information that we need to get. The duties that I'm responsible for are, like I said, crashes and investigating DUIs. I'm also a member of a fatal crash team, which means that I'm responsible to go to the hospital, deal with the hospital staff, and attempt to get all the information I can. Also pursue a warrant at times and take blood from the suspect. When we are not aware of a DUI driver that's been involved in a crash, there tends to be a lack of notification to the police agencies regarding the crash. I don't quite know the reasons for that, but the part that I'm mainly concerned about is once we get to the hospital, not being able to find out the information that we need to effectively investigate the crash and the DUI driver.
Excuse me, Officer Hull, I'm reminded that you perhaps didn't identify yourself for the record, but it is at the beginning, so I'm going to invite you to do that now.
I'm sorry for any mistakes. This is my first time. My name is Dark Hull, H-U-L-L. I'm a police officer employed by the City of Portland, currently assigned to the Traffic Division Motor Unit and Fatal Crash Team.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please go ahead.
In my personal experience and experience of my coworkers and speaking with other officers across the state, we find that there's a small amount of hospital staff who do not want to help us. There's a small amount of hospital staff that will do whatever it takes to help us. And then there's that large percentage that is somewhere stuck in the middle in between administration and doing the right thing. This House Bill 2895, I think, will help alleviate that issue with that large percentage and allow hospital staff to inform us of what they would like to do and inform us of those blood levels that we need to know.
Officer Hull, it'd be helpful for me and maybe for the committee in general too to understand just how the arresting officer or the attending officer at a motor vehicle crash, how do they always accompany somebody who's receiving medical care to the hospital, somebody who was the driver, under what circumstances do they do so because they suspect that the person was under the influence? How does that all play out?
Yes, sir, Chair. Typically, a 911 call regarding a crash initially gets sent to EMS services. Obviously, our primary concern is for life, and they want the medical people there to take care of the person as fast as possible. So there's a lot of times when the medical people arrive, scoop them up, and they're on their way to the hospital. So a lot of times police do not even have contact with the people who are involved in the crash until hours later, whenever they're able to make it to the hospital. A good percentage, and I'd say most of the time, police are able to see the suspect at the scene and are aware that there is some alcohol present, alcohol or controlled substances present in the person's system. However, to what extent, we do not know. Not being able to perform field sobriety tests, not being able to have real close personal contact with them because they are receiving care at a medical facility. 2895 allows us that crucial evidence that we need to have when we're not able to interview, we're not able to contact. It's essentially the missing link in our case, which allows us to get the evidence and to build the probable cause to further the case.
And would the police officer generally go to the hospital that's providing the care to the driver because of a suspicion that there was alcohol or drugs involved? Would that be the reason why the officer would go, or would it be routine to go even if there weren't that suspicion?
It depends. Typically, the police would go to the hospital to help do the investigation, to find out the pertinent information, what they believed happened. But there's a lot of times when the police are so busy that they're going call to call to call, and without the knowledge that possibly somebody's intoxicated or impaired, they wouldn't have that ability to get to the hospital for, say, several hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any further questions? Thank you, Officer Hall.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here who wanted to testify on House Bill 2895? Seeing none, then I'll close the public hearing on 2895. We understand, committee, there are amendments coming on the bill, so we'll proceed ahead to public hearing on House Bill 2896. Council Stanford, why don't you give us a quick review before Representative Barker presents his bill.
Thank you, Chairman McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2896 is indeed related to House Bill 2895. Present ORS 133.621 provides that a physician or a person acting at the request of a physician may withdraw bodily substances, pierce human tissue, perform medical tests, and otherwise use medical procedures to gather evidence in a criminal investigation. It also states that such physician or physician assistant is not civilly liable for such action, and that a physician is not required to act at the request of an officer. House Bill 2896 amends ORS 133.61 to require that a physician or assistant withdraw bodily substances, etc., if the physician or assistant is requested to do so by a law enforcement officer acting in the ordinary course of official duties. The provision about immunity from civil liability remains.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jeff Barker, state representative from District 28 in Beaverton, Iowa. And just kind of reflecting back on the last bill we talked about, one of the problems is isn't so much in the city of Portland, where there's a lot of officers, but out in the outlying areas where there may or may not even be a deputy working and the ambulance is called to an accident. That's when the police really need the notification. But I'm going to I'll go back to this bill. I'm going to try to keep my comments brief because, again, there are other witnesses. So I'll shorten my testimony on House Bill 2896. I sponsored this bill as a companion to House Bill 2895. It requires health care professionals to assist law enforcement collect evidence where there is probable cause to believe that a person involved in an accident has been driving while intoxicated. As with House Bill 2895, my office is working with the stakeholders to try to produce amendments to this bill that will alleviate much of the concerns of the healthcare professionals while still maintaining the intent of the legislation. As I said, there's other people to testify, so I'll finish here. Unless anybody has any questions, thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
There are no questions for Representative Barker. Thank him for bringing this bill forward. Let's have Ann Pratt and Marie Armstrong come forward again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Ann Pratt, and I'm here representing Crime Victims United. We've also brought with us Sergeant Tim Plummer from OSP, who will be helpful in answering any questions on this. Again, our goal is to change may to shall in conjunction with the other bill. Our goal is also to cooperate with the medical community in resolving the issue of identifying the intoxicated driver and getting them off the road. Law enforcement can successfully do their job. We can prosecute, and it also opens treatment for these people who continue to drink and drive. ER staff and trauma nurses we have talked with have indicated to us that they want to cooperate, but are sometimes directed by their supervisors or risk management not to and cannot do so. It is really at their suggestion that we brought this bill. And again, we hope to negotiate or have discussions with the medical industry to help resolve this problem. And this, again, is supported by ODAA, GAC, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And I'd like to kind of, I would like to refer back to the sheet that was with my testimony for 2895 in the story, not story, the actual report from Jeff Lance. It also indicates the request of the staff in wanting to help but cannot. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Pratt. Ms. Armstrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Marie Armstrong. And as you heard Ann state, this is what we're asking. And what I'm asking is that just to have one word changed so that the victims do not have to do most of the legwork. We need to make sure that we have public safety at its best, and we owe this to all of the citizens in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Armstrong. Sergeant Plummer.
Mr. Chair, members of this committee, I apologize for not signing up to testify. It wasn't my intent to provide testimony, but just to be a resource to the committee as to the scenario in which this is based out of and how this happens. Most of you are aware that DUII has two aspects to it. One of them is actually criminal prosecution. The other is the implied consent, wherein if somebody is arrested for DUII and they're receiving care in a medical facility, under Oregon's implied consent, we can draw or make a request for a blood draw to determine blood alcohol content. Oftentimes we're met, though, under Oregon implied consent law with this law right here, the one that's before us, 133.621, which says that in the state of Oregon, only a duly licensed physician or someone under their immediate control can pierce human tissue. That's not police officers. So under Oregon implied consent law, in order for us to collect this evidence under Oregon implied consent law, we need the help of these folks to do this. Another thing that prompted this was a meeting that was held March 9th in 2005 with our regional captain, Cal Kurtz, and the medical community about this very issue, about how can we work together. The medical industry's response to that is we could change the language from may to shall in here. They'd feel much more comfortable about being able to do that for law enforcement and collecting that evidence under implied consent. I think I just have to echo the sentiments that have already been echoed. There have been cases where medical facilities will even refuse to draw blood under implied consent, where we have read the implied consent, they are under arrest, and they won't. They just feel either because of the risk managers, the position on HIPAA, that they won't do it. So this comes from as a recommendation from the medical community as a result of that meeting March 9th. And that was their recommendation, is that we, if we could just change that language, their comfort level would go way up in being able to do that. Thank you very much.
And Sergeant, if, I think I may have missed it. You're formally identifying yourself for the record, so if you could do that now.
Yeah, I am sorry, sir. I have those notes right here in front of me, and I just ran right past it. I'm Tim Plummer with the Oregon State Police. I'm a sergeant in the Patrol Services Division. I work out of headquarters, and I am responsible for Oregon State's impaired driving programs.
Very good.
Thank you, sir.
Are there any questions for any person on this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate your coming. Again, Kevin Neely.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Kevin Neely, Oregon District Attorney's Association. I thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2896. Again, as of House Bill 2895, this is a bill that the Oregon District Attorney's Association strongly supports. I don't want to sound like a broken record. I think those who have testified before me have highlighted the main features of House Bill 2896 that are critical. Again, I would just reiterate, the thing that's most important for the prosecution is, one, get the evidence, two, get it to the law enforcement folks so that they can continue the investigation and conclude the investigation as quickly as possible, and three, get it to the district attorney's office so they can get the prosecution taken care of. These two bills in tandem help facilitate the effective prosecution of these cases. With that, I'd answer any questions.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Neely.
Sure.
And I don't know if I should have asked this question to Representative Barker, but maybe you can answer it for me. When Representative Barker introduced the bill as a sponsor just now he said something about where there's probable cause. But in the bill that I see, the probable cause part comes only in paragraph 2 that deals with the civil immunity. Do you know if that's part of the amendments that are being worked on to introduce some probable cause into the paragraph 1?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I'm sorry, I don't know.
We're taking all stakeholders in to
okay.
prepare any problems.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Neely. We'll go to Dark Hall then next. And I apologize to the witnesses who are having to walk back and forth. I suppose if I had seen the similarity, the overlap between these bills and the witness lists, I would have opened a hearing on them together. But we'll go at it.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson, members of the community. Again, my name is Dark Hall. I'm a police officer employed by the City of Portland and a member of the Major Crash Team Fail Investigator. Looking at this bill, spending a lot of time at the hospital like I do, we run into the dilemma of the small percentage that doesn't want to help us, the small percentage that will do anything we need them to do, and the people that are stuck in the middle. Shortly after a fatal crash that we had, we asked representatives from Emmanuel Hospital to attend one of our fatal crash meetings. When they arrived, it was one of their attorneys. They informed us that they would not take blood, period, unless there was a warrant or the subject consented. Now, under implied consent laws and state law, that typically, if the person's unconscious, we're allowed to take blood. They refused to do this. They refused to acknowledge exigent circumstances and have been quite unhelpful. And it's not an isolated incident. I work with 6 different hospitals on a regular basis. We see a lot of the same similarities between people wanting to help and people refusing to help. I think that this will help that large percentage in the middle that wants to help us. It'll help them with their administration and their legal concerns regarding the blood draws. I'd like to entertain any questions. I'm sure you have a lot.
Any questions for Officer Hall? Go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Chairman Pearson. Officer Hall, I have one question. Just in these cases that you're talking about where the hospitals don't give you information, I assume you're at the scene, you're there in the room, and say, can you give me blood alcohol content of this person? No. They tell you that they won't. My understanding of existing law is that they still, if they learn the BAC is over a .08, they still have to notify some law enforcement agency within 5 days. Do you know, to your experience, is that happening, and who is getting notified?
I can tell you in my personal experience that it's only happened 3 times in the past several years that I know of. I also work Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, which are the heights of our business because of the amount of drunk drivers that are on the road. Typically, that information is not getting to the proper agency when there may be officers present, when the issue can be alleviated instantly regarding that. If I could speak further.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead. I don't want the anybody to think that the officers are going to walk in and say, hey, this law says give it to me now, so I want it now. We don't work that way. We understand that, again, life is more important, that there's things that need to be done before hospital staff is able to help us. Personally, I've scrubbed up 3 hours after a crash and went and sat through an operation to get blood that I needed because I wanted to make sure that person was fine. I didn't want to interfere with their life. I didn't want to interfere with their care that was being given, and I didn't want to interfere with the hospital. So I don't want anybody to think that we're going to use this as a means of bullying, a means of forcing our way into areas that we're not supposed to be. It's simply a way to alleviate an issue and get the hospital staff and the police on the same page so that we can work together.
Mr. Chair? That's exactly the type of thing we're working on, the amendments to clarify for the medical professionals. Their job, you know, is to care for their patient, and so we want to be sure that there's no thought that Officer Hall could walk in and say, stop operating on this, you know, come over here and do this now, and that isn't the intent at all. And so that's what the amendments are about. We're going to be working very closely with the medical people and anybody else who wants to be involved in that to get this sort of work.
Okay. Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, I hope that we eventually pass both of these bills. We may need some work on them, but I would still have some concern that if we pass it, what do we do with, and it would be isolated, I would hope, people who refuse to still do it. So I'm hoping the work group will deal some way and have some discussion about how are we going to compel these people, and if they are not going to do it, then is there going to be a penalty section for the failure to do it? Maybe put their licenses on the line, but have a tendency to be a little more cooperative. Mm-hmm.
Any further questions for Officer Hall? Thank you, Officer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Next, Amy Alconich. And Ms. Meyer, you wanted to...
Yeah, there's a note that has me.
Yeah, that's fine.
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Amy Alconich, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association in opposition of this bill. And I'd like to start out with that I think where this bill is placed, is if it's meant to specifically apply to DUI investigations and crash investigations, that needs to be made clear in the body of the bill or where it is placed in the statutes. At this point, the way that I read the bill, this would apply to any criminal investigation, and it would compel doctors to withdraw bodily substances, pierce human tissue, perform medical tests and procedures, and otherwise use medical procedures to gather evidence in a criminal investigation. My understanding is that if this would like to be tailored more closely to apply to DUI law, we'd be happy to participate in helping to do that and work on the amendments. But the way that it's drafted now, we're concerned about how wide of a net this casts. And one of the issues we're concerned with is having an officer come in and the doctor say, well, this is what we need to do now, this is the best course of treatment, and the officer saying, you know, this, what I need is this evidence, and there is an expedited need for it because the blood alcohol will go down in 2 hours, or, you know, some of the evidence may go away. And we want to make sure that the primary function of the doctor is to care for the patient and not to collect evidence for a criminal investigation. And I know Officer Hull testified that that wouldn't happen, but I think that needs to be made clear in the statute that the primary purpose of the doctor is to treat the patient and not to be part of the criminal investigation mechanism. I'm also concerned about how broad the application is in terms of the last phrase that I read, which is essentially any other medical procedures to gather evidence. And if it is primarily addressed to DUI cases, then I think that that could be clarified to blood draws, urine, and breath, as we have in other DUI statutes. If there's a way to tighten that up, I think that would be incredibly helpful. I am concerned that there's no probable cause mentioned in Section 1 of the statute. I know it sounds like that's something that will be addressed, but that is a concern for us. And finally, one of my other concerns is that I just don't think doctors are trained to know some of the procedures in terms of what does need a warrant and what does need a court order. And my concern is that a physician may just act because they're told and not be familiar with the law, and in that way override the treatment of the patient. So we're willing to sit down and work on this to tighten up some of our concerns if that's something that everyone is open to, and it sounds like that will happen. It's just that at this point the net is too wide. We think it takes the doctor from just primarily treating the patient to being part of that criminal investigation, and that's something we'd like to avoid if possible. And that's our final statement about this, and we are happy to work on it.
Mr. Chair, please just contact my legislative aide.
Okay. Any further questions for Ms. Alconich? Ms. Meyer.
I'll make this brief. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, and joined with Amy today in opposition to House Bill 2896. I'm not going to repeat the points she made. They were clearly our points as well and the concerns we have, and we hope, and it sounds like this will be addressed, so we appreciate the opportunity to narrowly tailor this and provide some safeguards that need to be in there. Thank you.
Good. I want to just probe maybe one issue, which is the existence of probable cause. That is, is there sensitivity about an officer coming to the hospital believing that because of the
just what observing the circumstances of the accident, deciding it would be appropriate to do a blood draw. Would there be sensitivity about that determination by an officer, that that was just based on observing the scene of the accident and what had happened, that it would seem appropriate to take a sample?
Well, I think there are a few ways to answer that, Representative McPherson, members of the committee. The first is that we believe, in support of the officers, that they are trained to recognize some of the signs and are particularly in terms of Officer Hull, trained in traffic accidents to recognize some of the signs that somebody is under the influence of intoxicants, whether it be that they smell on their breath alcohol or they're exhibiting some of those symptoms. So we would hope that an officer who presents that to a doctor is acting in good faith, is truly believes that there's probable cause that there has been, that there is alcohol or drugs involved in the accident. My concern is that the doctor doesn't really have the tools. You're almost asking the doctor to determine if that probable cause is valid, and that's a concern. You're saying the officer will come in and say, well, we have probable cause that that this is intoxication, and if you have a position where the doctor says, well, you know, they don't smell like alcohol, they're not acting intoxicated, the doctor has no leeway or ability to say, well, we disagree with that. We don't think it's appropriate to draw blood in this situation, or that's not the best course of treatment. So I think there's a part of it is trusting that the officer is acting in good faith and is trained appropriately, and the other is that I would like the doctor to have some ability to make an independent medical judgment in those cases. I hope that addresses the question.
Well, I guess I'm still struggling with whose decision it is. That is, it would seem as though the medical professional, the physician, is not trained at all to make a determination, so that it really ought to be, shouldn't it be the officer's decision, and then if there were a lot of suppression of evidence later on in a prosecution, if the counsel for the defendant could then challenge the existence of probable cause, but we shouldn't be putting our medical professionals, our physicians, in the position of deciding whether or not the officer has some proper foundation for that.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I guess my response to that in part would be that, first of all, because this bill is not even narrowly tailored, and I know this committee has heard us speak already on the fact that we don't really agree that there's applied consent related to when you drive your car. But they're now, and so that's an underpinning to our concerns in getting a court order. It seems that there is, the person's in the emergency room, you know where they are, they're secure. If you need to move quickly, I would hope that they could get a court order because, as Amy said, the doctor can't evaluate that, shouldn't be put in that position. And the officer can probably easily obtain a warrant based on probable cause and move forward. But our concern always is when we remove the neutral oversight to, the powers of the government, ostensibly to do a search on a person, that we have those safeguards in place and we have a check on that. And again, most of the time I would think it would move with little or no problem, but in addition to this bill not being narrow, it would allow it for any situation. We just don't believe that when you're balancing the issues of obtaining evidence from people and the requirements we have under Article 1, Section 9, and the requirements for search and seizure, so we don't just give that up and continue to make exceptions to that, right now tied to automobiles, but, on and on. It's that slippery slope, we love to say in law school, but it is that area that we just continue to dismantle the protections that we think are critical and help everyone, I believe, not hinder, but actually help. You don't want a motion to quash. And leave, if there's evidence that's been obtained, you want it lawfully obtained on the front end so it can be used. You don't want to be in court arguing over motions to suppress, not quash, excuse me, but to suppress the evidence. That doesn't serve anyone. So I think the court provides that safeguard.
Representative McPherson, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'd just like to, members of the committee, respond that I think that if this was narrowly tailored to DUI investigations, that probable cause is something that there's specialized training that the officer has to establish, that how it is broadly now, you could have an officer come in on any case, a rape case, a assault case, and that probable cause is in some ways more difficult to establish the elements for. And so if it was more narrowly tailored to DUI investigations, you could have an officer come in and say they've exhibited X, Y, and Z on the DRE chart. This is probable cause. But where the way it is so wide now, I think would be much more difficult for an officer to come in and to have a doctor be responsive to that on any crime. And I think that that can be fixed potentially in a work group.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just glanced at the underlying statute that's being amended here. Is it being used, and we're just changing a word and adding that sentence. This is an existing statute. Is it being used in cases other than DUI cases, or is this part currently used in just DUI cases?
Representative McPherson, members of the committee, Representative Bonamici, I can't answer that for certain, honestly, although I can imagine that this is probably the statute that is used for additional investigations in other cases, like rape cases, when they do a rape kit at the hospital. So I can't imagine it, that this must be the statute, since this is the statute that is for medical investigation under the authority of the police.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Alkonich and Ms. Meyer. And we have two more witnesses, Jim Anderson and Tim Martinez. I will invite you to come up together.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. I hope it's all right. We also invited Bruce Bishop to join Jim and I, if that's okay with the chair.
Always welcome, Mr. Bishop.
Thank you.
Very good.
First of all, I want to thank the sponsor, Vice Chair Barker, for allowing us to participate in the work group. We haven't been involved to this point, and we appreciate your willingness to include us. I think most of the folks testifying prior to us have laid out the issue quite well and have laid out the concerns. It's not very often that I find myself testifying on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association and agreeing with both ACLU and the Criminal Defense Bar. So I have to write this day down in my journal in big letters. But the concerns they raise are similar to the ones the Oregon Medical Association has as well. We would definitely prefer to see this language, if it's going to move forward, placed in the DUI statutes rather than where it is currently written today. It's been discussed, and we can certainly go into that more if you want, that the times and the examples of cases where physicians and other healthcare providers do indeed provide some of these tests. The second piece that we have is the immunity question. There are some immunity protections in the current statute. I'd be happy to provide your counsel later, if I could, Mr. Chair, with some recent case law that we believe causes some doubt about the validity of those immunity statutes. So we do think it's important, and we would argue in the work group, that if you're going to require physicians or other medical professionals to perform these procedures, that the legislature should indemnify those healthcare providers. And we will get appropriate language for that drafted for the work group. So with that, I would stop and let my colleagues add their comments. I would say for the record that the way the bill is written right now, we would oppose, but I think when the work group we can get there. Thank you.
Excuse me, Mr. Martinez, you used the term indemnify, and I'm guessing that you didn't technically mean indemnify in the technical sense, but rather provide that the medical facility and medical professionals could not be held liable.
Right. Mr. Chair, I misspoke.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Jim Anderson with the Oregon chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify today, and I would thank Representative Barker. I spoke to him before the hearing. He relayed to me that they are working on amendments. We do look forward to working with you and your staff on getting those brought back to the committee. And I would echo what Mr. Martinez has just said. I would ask you to put yourself in the position of my physicians. Midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning, Friday, Saturday night, downtown Portland. all kinds of things are happening in an emergency department at a hospital. To have a physician look at a newly presented patient and understand that there is a criminal investigation going on is not number one on their mind. To stabilize that patient, treat the condition that patient is under, is primary to that doctor. And that's the way they will approach every case. If you want to increase a penalty section on a doctor, believe me, they are under enough pressure due to liability issues and other issues facing them that loss of their license is always a concern to them. You don't need to bring additional penalties against a doctor for not complying with the law that we are talking about today. In the bill, and the bill is related to criminal investigations, I mentioned that a doctor does not know when a criminal investigation is going on or when it's not. If an officer, and we heard testimony earlier, officers do not always accompany that patient to the emergency department. And if they don't, that doctor has nothing to stand on unless, of course, they are going to know that that patient is under the influence of alcohol, under the influence of some sort of drug that may be legal or illegal that's causing the impaired action. We just don't know. I'll leave it there. Again, look forward to working on the amendments with Representative Barker and his staff. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Bishop.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and appreciate the committee's indulgence for me to address Hospital 2896 briefly. We have been working with Representative Barker on these bills and look forward to continuing to develop amendments that accomplish the purposes of the proponents and address the realities of medical practice and hospital care. 2896 specifically raises the issue of the complications of state and federal law and patient confidentiality, you know, the implied consent law under state law, the HIPAA law, and these can be difficult issues to iron out in practice, both for law enforcement when they're involved in an incident and for medical professionals when they're providing medical care. I think there are some ways to reconcile those difficulties. I'm not sure that 2896 is ready for that, but I think we can work on it. And one of the complications is that if it is mandatory under state law for something to be done, that may overcome some of the limitations in federal law. That's part of what 2896, I think, is trying to address. But it may not be doing it quite as pointedly as needs to be done to address the specific problems that are raised by other witnesses on the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bishop. Questions? Representative Krieger.
Just a comment that Mr. Martinez was concerned about is finding himself lining up with the ACLU. There are several of us have found ourselves in that position and we have survived.
Well said. I want to pursue, Mr. Bishop, one of the things you alluded to, which is the federal HIPAA protections on confidentiality, and that would seem to be maybe in tension with the implied consent and the thrust of 2896, which is to then draw samples with which a prosecution can be proceeded on. Are there exceptions under HIPAA that would allow for this kind of sample taking and disclosure to law enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there are exceptions under federal law for matters that are required by state law. But part of the additional complication is the difference between a test for medical treatment and a test for forensic or legal purposes. So providers may have some ability to conduct a blood withdrawal in one setting, where they may not have that either under state or federal law in another setting. And I'm not, I believe that HIPAA, I believe that a state law that ordered a draw for legal purposes rather than medical treatment purposes would satisfy the federal requirement. I'm not entirely sure about whether HIPAA gets to non-medical treatment situations or is only focused on the medical care side of that and the interactions between a patient and a provider. So that's a I'm a little concerned about the legal, non-legal distinction and whether HIPAA reaches that. But I think if it's ordered under state law, you can overcome the HIPAA limitation.
Very good. Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your attendance. This is a work in progress. I appreciate the efforts that all the participants are putting into it, and we look forward to having both House Bills 2896 and 2895 coming back with amendments. I will close public hearing on House Bill 2896 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2847. Council Stanford.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2847 relates to certain exemptions from public disclosure under public records law. ORS Chapter 192 contains Oregon's public records laws. Generally, most public records must be disclosed unless they are specifically excluded. Several categories of records are exempt from disclosure. ORS 192.502 is one statute that contains a broad array of exemptions. House Bill 2847 adds a new exemption for the home address, home telephone, and email for district attorneys and deputy district attorneys if the attorney has requested such an exemption. The exemption does not apply if the information is already contained in property or lien records. And this morning received a dash one amendment to House Bill 2847, which would also add another exemption for former public safety officers, federal officers, as defined in ORS 802.250.
Thank you, counsel. We have Representative Crummell, I understand you have an amendment to present on this bill, but should we be hearing, you think, from other people to give us more, the more general background before you make a presentation, or do you on a schedule where you need to...
I do need to get back
down. Yeah, why don't you come forward, and since we've got the general orientation, you can present the amendment that you brought forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Mr. Chair, House Bill 2847 is a pretty simple bill, as Council has explained to you. One of the things that came to our attention, and it was actually after bill dropping time by a constituent of mine, Mr. Drew Garrison, and he is here and would like to testify also, is that federal officers that sometimes work in cases where they could be in danger even after retirement, don't seem to be exempted, particularly in the DMV statutes. We, in working with legislative counsel, we searched out a bill that possibly would, that we could amend the federal officers into, and when we found 2847, we contacted Representative Butler to ask him, ask for his permission, and of course he granted that. So the dash one amendments, Mr. Chair, would simply add, as noted by counsel, a former public safety officer, a federal officer, or a former federal officer. And by adding them, we can protect, I believe, our retired FBI agents, customs agents, and others that have worked for the federal government. We, in talking with legislative counsel, Mr. Reutlinger mentioned that we could just amend the motor vehicle laws, but I think being on a more broad spectrum would be, quite frankly, a good idea, and make sure that our officers, former officers, are well protected. I also recognize, Mr. Chair, that County Assessors Association may have a little bit of heartburn with this particular bill, but I think that in this particular case, there are ways to work around the issues that the county assessors have. I also think that they do bring up a good point from the standpoint of a more global discussion, but I think in the interim, while a more global discussion is occurring around who should be exempted from public disclosure, getting the protections for our public safety officers is extremely important. So I would urge the committee to take the bill into work session, add the dash one amendments, and then send the bill to the floor. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Representative Kremel? Thank you, Representative. And is that Mr. Garrison there with you?
It is, Mr. Chair.
We'll go ahead and take his testimony here now. And Representative Kremel, you can stay if you have time, or you can excuse yourself if you need to get back to committee.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I will go ahead and excuse myself because I do need to get back down to Ways
and Means. Look, thank you for your patience in waiting for us to get to this bill.
Thank you. No problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Drew Garrison. I'm a retired senior special agent with the federal government. I left Oregon in the early 80s to accept the federal agent job in California. I'll admit I went to California, but I came back to Oregon after putting in a full career and retiring. In California, I had DMV law enforcement confidentiality for my entire career. And in California, you take that into retirement. Prior to moving back to Oregon, I wrote Oregon DMV to find out how I get Oregon DMV confidentiality in my retired status, only to get a letter back from Oregon DMV that they only provide that to active law enforcement officers. Unfortunately, some of the reasons the protections are in place do not disappear just because you retire, particularly detectives, criminal investigators. They may have people in prison years after their retirement that one day get put on parole, and they may still harbor a grudge and they want to go find that person. And when I was talking to Representative, I was just mentioning to him that I couldn't understand why DMV did not extend that to retirees and asked if there was any chance that that could be done.
Thank you, Mr. Garrison. Any questions for this witness? Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Kevin Neely.
There's also another little issue. This is a public record now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the third time today, I'm Kevin Neely, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I don't think it'll surprise you to hear that the district attorneys strongly support House Bill 2847. In fact, this bill came through Representative Butler's office. We're very pleased he was willing to support it. It came out of District Attorney Dan Norris's office, and I'll get to that in just a second. I've submitted some written testimony on this bill. Obviously, I'm not going to read that testimony for you, but it does highlight, I think, three important reasons that this needs to happen. The first is that district attorneys and deputies are often the very face of a prosecution. They're the folks that the family and the offender see on the other side of the courtroom. That's the face that often is associated with someone going to jail. Consequently, those folks are often targeted for death threats, other sorts of threats to their family and to their persons. Again, I think the other two features that are in here that I've highlighted, really, this also puts district attorneys and their deputies in line with all of the other law enforcement officials. They're not currently public safety officers. This aligns them with other public safety officers, which I think is a reasonable thing to do. And with that, I would pass on just a couple of anecdotes. One of them is a personal anecdote. Some of you may or may not know, my father was a district attorney for almost 30 years. And as I was growing up, one of the things that's most memorable to me about that time is those days that I'd come home and there'd be a new mugshot on the fridge. And that mugshot would be someone that had just issued a death threat to my family, to my father. And here's how the conversation would go. Hey, Kevin, I've put a new picture on the fridge. If you see this person at the door, it's best not to answer the door and call the police. And only one time did that person actually show up at the door. But as you can imagine, that's a pretty it's a pretty scary thing for the family members of these folks, not to mention the district attorney or the deputy themselves. And so that's just a personal anecdote. I can also tell you that as this bill came up for a hearing, I sent an email out to about 20 of the deputies that are on our legislative committee. And of those 20 deputies, 13 of them sent back to me individual stories in which a offender or the family of an offender had threatened them and threatened their family. So again, I think it's absolutely critical that we provide these individuals all the protection we can. This is a very basic protection that's already afforded to other law enforcement officers. It seems only sensible that we include district attorneys. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Neely. In regard to the Dash 1 amendments, which would add in federal former public safety officers, federal officers, and former federal officers, would you lend the same type of strong support that those types of individuals dealing with some of the same types of issues that district attorneys deal with would be a logical inclusion in this bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Flores, I can't speak on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We hadn't seen these amendments until today. I would be surprised if they weren't in support of including retired folks. In fact, I thought, well, geez, we haven't included retired district attorneys in this either. Again, they don't have a formal position on it.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Thank you. And would you happen to have any information by way of background in comparing what other states do? And I think that Mr. Garrison had referred to California law in regard to protections and provisions for public safety officers and former federal officials, federal officers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, unfortunately, I don't have any other information other than anecdotal information. I know that in Arizona, where I grew up, the district attorney now can list an alternate address in any sort of public arena. And I don't think that's an uncommon provision in the law, but I can't tell you with certainty what the – I mean, I think every other state has sunshine laws, and I suspect that some do and some don't.
Thank you.
Mr. Neely, I'm just looking at the structure of the statute, and there's this this second sentence that's in the new addition to the new section, subsection 35. It's paralleling the existing sentence at the end of 34, which says this exemption does not apply to addresses and telephone numbers that are contained in county real property or lien records. And one of the reasons I ask about that is that Representative Wisnett has received, although I don't think it's been received by other members of the committee, a letter from the Oregon State Association of County Assessors expressing concerns about this bill and some others that expand public records exemptions. And are you familiar with what is this simply to allow them to continue to provide that information as to who the owner of record is of property?
Mr. Chair, I do believe that's what this provision is in here for. I can tell you that we requested the bill to be drafted in a way that aligned the district attorneys with other public safety officers. I'm not certain, probably should know, because I remember this bill from 2005 that included public safety officers, and I just can't remember off the top of my head why that provision was in there related to real property and lien documents. I apologize, I don't know that, but I know there are people here from the assessor's office.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. Mr. Neely, their comments talk about it being an expense, and they're asking that a work group be assigned to look at HB 2130, HB 2442, HB 2847, Senate Bill 493, and Senate Bill 475. And they go into it will be a tremendous cost. Suppressing name and address will be costly. Liability exposures for counties and county staff. We need to get the ACLU back in here. Removing name and addressing information from ATT records may not provide the desired security. So
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, what I can tell you, my understanding of the public records law, and most of this comes from the time in which I was at the Department of Justice and was the main person working on public records matters there, I'm not sure that, again, well, two things I would say. One, I don't think it's a bad idea, as Representative Crummell said before me, to sit down and look at the public records law and work with those folks who are, in fact, the custodians of the records to try to find a way to effectively ensure that the people who are granted protections by this body get that protection. That's a real challenge. If you are the tax assessor or you are the county clerk, how do you know someone is a deputy or the district? Maybe you should know that they're the district attorney, but how do you know if they're a deputy? I think that's a real challenge that is faced. I'm not sure if there is any history of liability in those cases. I frankly think most of these public bodies probably are covered under other sorts of protections. But that being said, I don't think that's a bad idea. But also, as Representative Crummell said, I do think that it's high time that we offer these folks, the district attorneys and their deputies, the same protections that are granted to other law enforcement officials. And the reason I say that is because probably more so than any other law enforcement official in the chain of a prosecution, the district attorney takes on the personal face of that prosecution. They're the ones that are banging on the table in front of the judge and asking for the sentence. So, again, we'd be more than happy to work with whatever public body or custodians to try and ensure that we can provide them with the information they need to effectively enact this law or adhere to this law, but that doesn't in any way diminish the need for the law.
Any further questions for Mr. Neely? Thank you, Mr. Neely.
Thank you.
Next, Mark Noakes.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, committee members. My name is Mark Noakes. I'm the elected county assessor for Linn County and also appointed tax collector. Just as a side note, I probably was threatened at least three or four times as your as a county tax collector this past tax season. And I think the point has been made today by the people preceding me that our point as county assessment and tax collectors are is where will it end? I think we said that in 2005 when the public safety officers came before us. Is how do we administer this program when one group after another after another after another starts hopping on the bandwagon? And certainly our letter to this group a couple weeks back, our hope was that every legislature had a copy of this letter, and you can see by the date when we got this letter out that it was our hope that we could meet and come to some conclusion or reasonable explanation or solution to the suppression of names for those individuals that seem to want it. I'm not going to try and repeat what is in the letter to you. I love my DA. I'm not going to sit here and say that I am against this bill. I actually, kind of hard to answer that question, neutral for or against. I'm neutral from the standpoint of I believe in the public safety of our elected officials and including our public safety officers. But the point is that first, we have public safety officers. Now we have DAs and their assistants. Then we have medical professionals coming down the pike under Senate Bill 493, and it just the list goes on and on and on. So I would ask this group, and that it's really a request from the Association of County Assessors and the Association of Tax Collectors, that there be some interim work group that works towards a solution that meets everybody's needs in terms of this name suppression, because it becomes an administrative burden on my office as the county assessor in providing information to the public.
So Mr. Noakes, if I'm following you right, the concern isn't so much with the particular change being made here as it is with the pattern of individual exemption for particular public employees, public officials.
Chair McPherson, that's correct. Linn County has had a process since 1996, and many counties had the process, and the process simply was you get a court order, we'll remove your name from the record. Linn County then got a board of commissioners that set up a little bit different policy, and I currently have 17 on the books that are suppressed in one way or another. As the law is written, for public safety officers, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because our records contain so much information that describes where that property is. Map, tax lots, all that information, is that removing the address wasn't the solution. And therefore, in Linn County, we suppress names.
Any questions for Mr. Noakes? Thank you, sir. And you are?
Mr. Chair, I'm Mike MacArthur. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here in support of Mr. Noakes and the Assessors Association. Our Legislative Committee has taken a similar position. We believe it's time to declare a moratorium. We do support the intent of this legislation. We do believe that we should have protection for those folks that are in public eye and in sensitive positions. In fact, I know some county commissioners that would like that protection, and perhaps there are some legislators may like that too. However, it seems as though there needs to be a larger discussion of public records in general and what we do to protect those folks and how we do it. As Mr. Noakes has pointed out, there are many other ways that people can discover the identities and addresses of folks. So, I mean, there's pressure right now to open up public records and in other bills and other committees that we're hearing about. We would like to have a work group convened that could take a more comprehensive view of this and determine a policy that would work for everyone.
Okay, any questions for Mr. MacArthur? Thank you, gentlemen. Sarah Myers.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Myers. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. We understand that there's a necessity stated here for the unconditional exemption being requested by the district attorneys, and while generally speaking we do prefer to see public records exemptions, however necessary, subject to ORS 192-501, which includes a public interest test, we do recognize that there's already existing a similar unconditional statutory exemption that extends to public safety officers, and that the stated use for this exemption is the result of a need for personal security and personal privacy matters. With that said, though, to the extent that there are other ways to protect the privacy of, for example, address and name information outside of public records exemptions, we certainly do prefer that we have an opportunity to review whether or not those statutory opportunities are utilized first and foremost. And to the previous folks that just testified, we too also would welcome an opportunity to review the plethora of additional requests for exemptions that are currently in the system being considered both on the House and the Senate side. So I would be happy to answer any questions, but at this time we're really not taking any general position on this bill other than to say that we understand the need for the request.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Myers. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU. Generally, when we look at and see public records issues, we want the government to be very narrow and very concerned about exempting anything. And as the previous witness testified, there's two sections in our public records. One is the exempt from disclosure unless the public interest requires disclosure,
And so there's a standard that's met, but then the information can be available. And then there's Section 5.502, which is just a complete disclosure. We're very concerned whenever we start adding things to that. And certainly we have no particular concerns about home address information or home telephone. The area I would have concern would be email, and I realize that they were simply aligning it with subsection 34, which I think Mr. Neely mentioned was 2005, and I have to admit, I guess I missed that one, because I would have raised that issue. I think the home address, and as Mr. Neely testified, to the concerns of someone showing up at your door and raising a safety issue to you and your family is one thing. Electronic email address doesn't seem on its face, and I'm happy to hear any argument as to why, it raises that level of security issue. It's how people communicate with public officials, and it's important to be able to have that access. And so we would ask that you narrow this just a titch to remove that, again, because if you're working in the exemption of 502, we urge always to be extremely narrow. Would actually prefer the section to be in 501, and then when the public interest requires it, and that's a high standard, let me assure you, it's accessible. Those are my comments today, and I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer, I imagine every deputy district attorney in the state has a state email address where people could get to them, so I wouldn't see any problem with exempting their private personal email address. I mean, that they're dealing with the scum of the earth a lot of times, the deputy district attorneys are. They're dealing with violent, vicious people that most of us are fortunate enough to never come in contact with. And those people do bear grudges, and they are threatening, and those people need security.
Chair McPherson, Representative Barker, let me approach it slightly differently in my thinking about this is, ostensibly, this doesn't qualify to their personal email address, and I don't know that it would be out there in the public record to begin with. What's out there in the public record to begin with is their government address, and you're probably right. It's name, maybe period, in between the first and second name, at whatever. So I'm not sure it would ever really be a barrier that it was exempted, but it seems to create a huge complication. I don't know how anyone would enforce that. You know, if a DA sends out an email to someone, they've got it. They're doing it in their capacity of their job. Their home address is different. They're not engaged in their employment exchanging their home address and home telephone number. So if it were their personal email, I don't think that's what our public, you know, that's where we should go, because I don't think that's normally obtainable like a home address is. And if it's their government email, then I think I'd be even more concerned about excluding that, because that is the way they communicate and people communicate back with them.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, the meeting we had the other day where they took a girl's first name on the computer, in 8 minutes they had her family, where she lived, everything about with technology today, with computers and emails. I don't think that you can, no matter what you do, you're going to be able to exclude that. There's too many ways to get into all that information.
Representative Forrest.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it is my understanding, Ms. Meyer, that private email addresses, i.e. home email addresses, are available through various service providers. And so if we're talking about home addresses, home telephone numbers, home email addresses are widely available through various service providers who do that type of service. So I would be very concerned about that.
Well, Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, I certainly stand to be corrected, but it would be my instinct and knowledge that service providers are not going to turn over people's email addresses unless there's a court order or some other action going on. We don't list our email addresses in the phone book. They aren't on our tax records. They aren't kind of circulating necessarily through other public entities. We're talking about information that's contained and may be required currently to be contained in the public record, which is what's required to be maintained is probably, you know, their home address and to some degree their phone number. You have the ability to not have your phone number listed, but and maybe even have your address not listed, but it's easier to obtain. And I just see a difference between the email when they're acting in the scope of their business and their behalf of the state, that their, you know, professional email not be exempted. When you get to the private email, I just think you start going down a really complicated path when you do that with the public record. An email address doesn't give location. The issue is security, is my understanding. The issue is threat to safety. Indeed, if someone got a hold of someone's email and sent them a threatening email, that's good evidence that the DA actually, or the person who received it, might want to have to move forward with addressing some safety concerns. So, again, to us, it's, you know, never put something in the exemption 502 unless there's just a really high threshold that's met. And, again, we don't have concerns with the personal home address and the personal telephone number. But this doesn't just say personal electronic mail. It's not narrow to that. And it would seem odd to start going in that direction in our public records laws.
Any further questions?
Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
Thank you.
Committee, before I close the public hearing on this, I want to get just a little discussion maybe in the public hearing setting. We've got, we have what appears to my view quite an innocent expansion. It is kind of a piecemeal, so there's a subject to the criticism we've heard that it appears that we're going at this thing rather piecemeal. We have yet another piecemeal expansion that's been proposed in the -1 amendments, I just wanted to get a sense about from people about whether they think that there are things that need more broader work.
I don't know how you go about doing that other than piecemeal as we learn technology and what people are doing. I don't know how else you go about doing it.
Yeah. We can't hear you. Yeah. We're having a hard time hearing over here. Well, Mr. Chair, I would like to see further work on this. I think it's something we should be pursuing as opposed to setting aside.
I think we should not be setting this aside. I think this should move forward, and the question is whether it was ready to move today, and that's why I rather wasn't able to.
Mr. Chair, I'd go ahead and move this today with the dash ones, personally. I think this is a good exemption, and I'm hearing what especially the counties are saying there. Take a very hard look at other ones, but these people are vulnerable. I have trouble saying that, but they are dealing with really evil people. I mean, it isn't just like your usual, you get annoying, they're not annoying people, they're dangerous people that they deal with. And even with this, I mean, they're still pretty wide open. I mean, I can remember prior to internet days, long before the internet was around, when an officer I worked with, Black Panther, called his wife up and said, "We not only know where you live, we know your child goes to so-and-so's school, is Miss so-and-so's class, and we're going to kill your child." You know, people are able to track down information, but this makes it a little bit more difficult, and the deputy, especially the deputy DAs, and most of whom around the state are not allowed to carry firearms in and out of the courthouse, and I mean, they can probably get their own license, but they can't bring the gun to work, I think need the additional protection.
I'm looking around to see if that seems to be the sense of the committee. Then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2847 and open a work session on House Bill 2847. We've had part of our discussion as it is. We have the -1 amendments, which don't go to the DA, deputy DA issue. It goes to the former police public safety officer and former current or former federal officer. So it's a related but different issue, and so the one might approach that differently from the original bill, which was for DAs and deputy DAs. So I guess let's consider first then the -1 amendments, whether people feel that we should be adding that onto this bill in order to move that piece as well as the DA piece.
I would move that as well. It's similar and. As the witness testified, and once you retire, doesn't really change things. And people are in prison you know, maybe not get out till after you're retired and maybe looking for you. I think that would be helpful.
Right. I'll take that as a motion then.
I move the dash ones into 2847.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2847. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2847 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2847 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Wisnett, do you have
I have a question, comment? Mr. Chair. Based upon the testimony we heard today from the Association of Counties and the County or the Association of Assessors, is there a physical impact on this? And we need to look at that. That's probably not a state. And also, I'll give you a yes vote, Mr. Chair, but I would like maybe the minister or our council to discuss this to see if they could get some quick fixes or something, if they have other people or something that before it comes to the floor or something. Just at least meet with the Association of Counties representatives. That would be my recommendation.
Well, we ought not move the bill today if we were going to try to get that input. As it is now, we have the dash one amendments in the bill, and let's say if we held off in order to get that further input, then I'll
withdraw my motion to move it to the floor today then, and it allow time for.
But I think I think the sense of the committee I'm drawing is that we should have to bring it back at an early time here, so I think we ought to let this one rest very long.
That's fine. Okay. Let's give them a little bit of time to see if they have a quick fix or suggestion.
Okay, very good. Well, I appreciate your withdrawing your motion, Representative Barker. That concludes, I will close the work session on House Bill 2847. That concludes our agenda. Committee members, thank you for participating. We are adjourned.